charge E1. And now these two.
Sorry. Already started. Okay.
These two isometries get gauged by the graviphoton. Upon turning on H3. So I'm not getting the up and down right every time, but...
Okay, so, for example, the P's go with XC's and the Q's go with XC tildes.
And finally, this isometry gets gauged by a graviphoton upon F6. Okay. So the natural question to ask now is, what about all other combinations? So for all the combinations being charging these under the vectors, how do I get those from string theory? Now, I've turned on so far F4 and H3, so I haven't exhausted all of my, and F6, I haven't exhausted all of my fluxes. It turns out if I turn on F2, I get what Sergey was referring to earlier, that I generate magnetic charges for the hypermultiplets. And I don't want to do that because I want to be able to write down a Lagrangian in four dimensions. But in any regard, turning on F2 has nothing to do with gauging these isometries under vectors. And finally, there's F0. But F0 turns out to be problematic because if I turn on F0, I generate a D6 brain charge from a Chern-Simons term, which I need to cancel by including either D6 brains or which I need to cancel by including anti-D6 brains, and then I break supersymmetry explicitly, and I don't have a four-dimensional n equals two description. So based on fluxes, this is the best we can do. Okay. And then in the final part of my talk, I'll say, well, how do we go beyond fluxes? How can we imagine going beyond fluxes? Before I do that, I want to, however, talk about corrections to the picture so far.
Can I?
Sure.
That's one question. So what characterizes the graviphoton is that it couples to the gravigenome, usually.
Okay.
So if you gauge, for example, without matter multiplets at all, gauge and you get an anti-de Sitter sign type cosmological constant.
Without matter, with not even the universal hypermultiplet, you mean?
Without even the universal hypermultiplet.
So that's hard to get from string theory.
I know.
Okay.
But just to illustrate, and the graviphoton becomes charged. Sorry, the gravitinos become charged under the graviphoton.
Okay.
So here, are your gravitinos charged with respect to the graviphoton? In these gaugings?
No.
You don't know.
I wouldn't assume.
In other words, the supersymmetry commute with the gauge transformation. Or is there a non-trivial algebra?
Yeah, I actually don't know. Peter, do you know?
Well, as I said, this is an answer to the question to begin. Absolutely, you have not gauged, I think, the whole O to the R.
Well, you don't know. You can't tell.
Well,
we need more details to determine that. You have to answer the question that I just asked.
I think the whole approach here is, as I said, factorization of what you say. So that gauging of the R7 group, by the way, that can always be done. Now, sometimes people combine that photon with the photon in the vector multiplier. There are many articles on that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not discussed here.
Well, no, I think that's
people
not clear.
Do that,
okay.
But I don't think it's done.
So, yeah, so maybe that's a detailed question again, since we're
right.
Running a little short, but
right.
We should discuss it afterwards. Yeah.
You can do that.
Okay.
What you haven't addressed is, sorry, just one last comment.
Sure.
What you have not addressed is the coupling of the vector multiplet. The special Taylor geometry to the actual gauge fields. The special Taylor geometry metric How does that enter the kinetic term of the gauge field?
Oh, but that's term. But that's in the standard way even before gauging.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying how is the how's the gauge kinetic term related to the prepotential? I mean that's
so the the question is, does the graviphoton is there just a prepotential? Do you have, as Peter said, sometimes the graviphoton gets mixed in with the other gauge fields, and other times you can sort of separate it out as sitting in a vector multiplet or not. So
okay,
I think,
well, let's again, maybe we should talk about this later. So I was going to talk about alpha prime. Yeah, sure.
Do you have array intervals and other cutoff integers?
I'm sorry?
Do you have array intervals and other cutoff integers?
In fact, good question. In fact, the reason, again, in that paper with Shamik, we studied type 2a, is to avoid the need to array intervold. So remember in 2b, when you turn on H3 and F3 that's crossed, you generate d-brain charge, and you need to either array intervold or add anti-brains to cancel that. But by doing that, you get an explicit n equals 1 description in 4 dimensions, because our intervals break explicitly, unlike fluxes that break spontaneously. In 2a, if you look at the Chern-Simons terms, which is one way of understanding where the charges, the tadpoles, come from, you see that the only tadpole you get is for F0. So if you avoid F0, you don't need to orientifold for consistency.
And you don't have any tadpoles or Gauss laws here?
So again, if you leave away F0 and just look at what the Chern-Simons term does for you. So remember, you know, for... For type 2b, you have a term like this. So you see that if H3 and F3 are crossed, you'll get something that looks just like the D3 brain action for C4, so you get a charge for C4. And so now you can just ask what are the possible, or you look at the Chern-Simons terms in type 2a and do the same analysis, and you see that you get a charge for C5, which is D6 brains, only if you have F0. Okay, so corrections. I was going to talk about alpha prime corrections, but maybe because this is taking a little bit longer than I anticipated, I'll just skip that and talk about G-string corrections, which are more interesting, maybe, for the following reason. Our slogan was fluxless gauge isometries, and for that slogan to catch, we need to have isometries to gauge. Okay. If at tree level, if you do the reduction, you'll see that the quaternionic space is always in a form that has exactly those isometries. But now, what about stringy corrections to that?
So alpha prime corrections don't change that fact because they're basically higher derivative.
In fact, I would show that we can incorporate. So everything here is up to the two derivative level, first of all. So alpha prime corrections are Wolf-Cheadle instanton corrections, which we can incorporate exactly. Into the special Kähler manifold of the vectors. They in fact don't enter the quaternionic manifold because they're alpha prime, which means that they scale with R. So the quaternions don't depend. The hypermultiplets can't depend on those. Can depend on the internal radius because of the splitting between hypers and vectors. Okay, so that was the alpha prime discussion. Now, G string corrections come in too. Guises, there's perturbative and non-perturbative. And I won't say anything over here about the perturbative ones, but in a sense, these are the ones we should worry about more for the following reason. The isometries that are present in the quaternionic manifold descend, roughly speaking, from shift symmetries in the gauge potentials in 10 dimensions. So what I mean by that is if I have C3 in 10 dimensions always only appearing as a field string, so it's DC3, then obviously there's going to be a shift symmetry in C3. Okay, and that descends to the isometries we were talking about. Okay, this is a rough discussion because there's also Chern-Simons terms, which do depend on the potential, which is why the isometries aren't just shifts. Okay, and roughly the reason that the supergravity action in 10 dimensions has this shift symmetry is because there are no charges for the Ramon-Ramon fields. Okay, so that's why we only have field strength appearing. But now, of course, string theory contains objects that carry Ramon-Ramon charges, which are D-brains. And in fact, the action of the D-brain is going to contain a piece e to the C3. Okay, so if C3 appears in the bare form without a derivative acting on it, this shift symmetry is going to be broken, so the isometry you would think would be broken in four dimensions. Without an isometry, I won't be able to gauge, and the whole prescription falls on its nose. Okay, so how do we get around that? Now, these terms like this are going to arise due to D2 brain instantons, okay, and D2 brain instantons wrapping certain three cycles in the Calabi-Yau. So let me write that three cycle as gamma. Okay, my board work, I'm afraid, is rapidly disintegrating. And gamma is going to be sum over bases of H3, which I'm going to choose. Okay, so let me introduce some notation. So gamma I is an H3 of X, and I'll introduce a dual basis. Previously, I had alpha A and beta A, but let me just denote all of them like this because this distinction isn't going to be important now. Okay, so the term we get here in particular is something like this, okay, where these NIs depend on what cycle we have the D2 brain. So wrapping and the CI are the scalars that appear in C3. So these are the hypermultiplet scalars. So we see in particular that the shift symmetry of CI goes into CI plus BI is going to be broken. So broken unless so except for very special cycles. This shift symmetry will be broken. There's an I here, you're saying? Okay, I'm not. And there's also a 1 over G string. I'm not being being schematic.
I just about continuous symmetry, it's not discrete symmetry.
Good. So what we see is what we get is a constraint on what cycles the U2 brain instanton is allowed to wrap. Okay, and now where could that constraint come from? Well, actually, it turns out that it's just so this is constraint. Yeah, you're okay.
No.
No, if I have an I here, then if this thing is 2 pi. A multiple of 2 pi, then, yeah, you're right.
But that's the charge. Ni, pi is the charge. The shift is there's an arbitrarily small parameter epsilon multiplying that when you do the shift. Shift by some constant.
The continuous group is broken to a discrete subgroup.
No, okay.
Right, but
yeah.
We're interested in whether there's a continuous group.
Yes.
Isometry, we're looking for the ones which have a continuous group.
Right. So they're both the PIs? Yes. Thank you. You're right.
Okay. There is no, but I'm just saying the discrete group is bigger than what's written on
the board. The discrete group is bigger, but like Martin pointed out, we're gauging a continuous symmetry. Okay. So now where can such a constraint come from? In fact, it's just Gauss's law. Okay, what do I mean by that? We have H-flux, and we're wrapping cycles that have H-flux through them. Now, H-flux induces magnetic monopole charge for the gauge field on the D2 brain. A simple way or a mnemonic more than a derivation, is that you take the Bianchi identity, and now you remember that in the action of the brain, F is replaced everywhere by F plus B, required by gauge invariance. So this is a... Well, I mean, I'm not paying attention to signs, but it just tells you that H sources F magnetically. Okay. Now, since the three cycle is compact, we have to have the charges vanishing on it. The sum of charges has to vanish. So that means that the sum of the integral of H over gamma has to be zero. Okay. And this, of course, is nothing other than NIPI. Okay. So that's a nice result because it shows the interplay of string theory and some stringy input into this purely supergravity analysis. It shows that generically isometries are going to be broken, but in fact exactly the isometries we want to gauge, which is determined by what flux we turn on, are those that are protected because of the flux. Okay, so that's a nice consistency condition. Okay, so we don't write down the Lagrangian, but we give all the data you need to go back to this paper, the review paper by Ferrara, Doria, whoever else was that on that big N equals 2 gate supergravity review paper.
Okay.
And you see what the action is.
So we can look it up.
Definitely, yes.
Exactly. So the gaugings, all that is are included.
Yeah, so we give the killing prepotential and everything you need. Okay, so we're approaching the end of my talk, which is beyond Calabi-Yau. Plus flux. So remember, the problem is, how do I gauge these isometries under the vector multiplets? And algorithmically, algorithmically, Ferrara and his collaborators have answered this question based on work by Lewis, Miku, Waldrum, etc., inspired by work of Kumruns. Okay, and the algorithm they give is the following. They say, do the same field decomposition you did for Calabi-Yau with fluxes, but now assume that the omega I, so the symbol omega I you use, is no longer a harmonic two form, but in fact it's not closed. It has an expansion. And further assume the following expansion. Okay, I hope I can see. Okay, where omega i's are still harmonic four forms, but now we don't know what these two and three forms are, but they should satisfy this relation, where these a's and b's are integers, and they have to satisfy a certain constraint. So now,
why is this reasonable?
Okay, good question. But before I tell you why it's reasonable, let me just tell you what it does algorithmically. So now you have a machine. You can plug this into the field expansion. You can plug the field expansion into the action, the 10-dimensional action. You can reduce to four dimensions. You see the gauge covariant terms you get are exactly those that that involve gauging these isometries under the vectors, okay, where these A's are the necessary charges.
Okay. So this, you need to do this to get the gauging.
So this is one thing you can do to get the gauging.
So is this equivalent to turning on fluxes? Or this is the
No. I haven't turned on fluxes. Right? I've done something funny. I've taken my expansion and I've assumed, I haven't told you where to get these forms. Mm-hmm. I've just said, let's assume they're not harmonic. Okay? And so, actually, like I said, follow this recipe.
Oh, it is equivalent to
this is flux. A new Kaluza-Klein reduction, something more
it's,
general.
Yes.
But you can
yes.
see, it's a, if I plug this in.
It can't be general to turning on, it can't be equivalent to turning on fluxes because the result is a different gauging. So it's an addition to turning on fluxes. I've done,
but it must be related to turning on fluxes because notice
it's on top of turning on fluxes.
The F, you get terms proportional to omega i's.
No, but this is analogous to in algebraic topology. First, you do cohomology, and then you do higher order things like a higher order, the Massey product or something. It's got something which is closed. Well, I mean, d squared is zero comes from the other other two equations.
Right, so actually for d squared equals 0, there's one constraint you have to still impose upon the a's and b's.
It's just a set of Kretov-Mauer equation.
I'm sorry, this is what?
A set of Kretov-Mauer equation.
Sort of.
Exactly. Because
as
he says, d squared is 0, so...
Okay. So let me add some comments maybe to...
Free differential algebra, people sometimes call these things. Because, as Mark says, not all of them are one forms. But that's not.
Well, free differential algebras give you something other than ordinary gauge symmetry. You don't have a Lie algebra anymore in four dimensions, right?
In fact, he is one of the experts. Free differential algebra, what I meant, well, what we meant long ago was a Kretov-Mauer system for higher P forms. And that's exactly what you have.
Okay.
But the question is, why is this?
Yeah, so let me now add some comments on that after Martin asks the question.
Sorry. It just seems, I'm being stupid, I guess, but it seems to me that for special choices of your A's and B's and C's, A's, B's, and C's, you could make, this could mock up a flux gauging.
Is that incorrect?
You cannot get flux gauging out of it?
Yes. The reason I can say that with confidence is because I can't get vectors to gauge those isometries by turning on fluxes, and this is exactly what this does. But I'm not sure. Actually,
no, that it's the other way around. I didn't say that fluxes can give you this, but that this.
Oh, and this so and these
can give you the flux.
No, but what these what these give you is exactly charges of the of gauging these isometries under vectors. So it's.
Or rather than graviphoton.
Yeah, or rather than gauging this under vectors, so it's really exclusive. Actually, we can write it down later. Or I don't know if you've already started. You see if you write it down that they're different terms. Okay, but now to Peter's question. So why is this? What are we doing? Okay, so I have a few comments. Now this is.
So what does the word reasonable mean in this question?
Well, the theory came from Tendermans with standard Kaluza-Klein reduction. You omega satisfied the field equation.
Yeah.
And therefore, whatever you got low was embedded in the higher dimensional theory. By relinquishing that interpretation of omega, you have relinquished the link with the original fundamental theory.
Yes.
You've gone beyond it. So maybe you're going to say,
let's see what I'm...
I'm going to say many things, but now you say
I'll say a few things, and then you're welcome to add some comments. The first comment is the following. When you have gauge supergravity, you get a potential, so you're breaking... The potential generically breaks supersymmetry. Okay. The reason we did Calabi-Yau compactifications is because we wanted to have preserved supersymmetry, so we required having covariantly constant spinners on the Calabi-Yau. If we go beyond that, and we only want to have an action that has n equals 2 supersymmetry, but don't insist on the solutions being supersymmetric, all we really need to have is the right number of spinners that don't vanish on the 6 manifold. We can relax the Calabi-Yau condition. Okay. And so we replace the Calabi-Yau by the condition that you have non-vanishing spinners, which is an SU3 structure manifold. Okay. So now we should consider...
Is this basically Calabi-Yau with torsion, or what do you mean?
I'm not sure about what Calabi-Yau with torsion means, but it means that we now have spinners which aren't covariantly constant under the... aren't covariantly constant under the Christoffel connection, but under a torsion-fold connection. So
yes,
then...
That's
okay. So that's good. And now if you have an SU3 structure manifold with these spinners on them, you can actually define... So this, you can define a two-form J and a three-form omega, but now J and omega are no longer closed. Okay. So this smells.
What does that phrase mean? Actually, three structure manifold. It means the torsion is not zero of the connection. What do you mean?
There's no.
Connection.
So
with SU3 holonomy, but it's not the Lie HV connection. It's a connection with torsion.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay.
Connected on the tangent bundle with SU3
homomorphic.
That's what
right. Or that the structure group on the tangent bundle is reduced to SU3. It's no longer SO6 or SU4, but it's SU3, so which is equivalent to...
The tangent bundle, right?
Yes.
But it's not just... I mean, for example, this connection will preserve this J and omega. Right?
The torsion-full connection?
The torsion-full connection, right?
So these are covariantly constant, but with regard to that new connection.
Basically, you're just putting torsion.
Okay. But so anyway, these conditions, they're reminiscent of what we're doing over here. If we think of expanding J, you know, in something like this, I forget if upper or lower was. Then we reproduce this. And in fact, some years ago, Kamran made this suggestion based on mirror symmetry that we should consider compactification manifolds where J isn't closed, for the reason that when we're considering a mirror symmetry in the presence of fluxes, the Ramon-Ramon fluxes behave well because we have an exchange of even and odd cohomology and of even and odd fluxes. But for the H flux, you have three forms on the one side of the mirror, but on the other side you need an NSNS2 form, and the question is, well, what do you take? So this is a candidate, J. And now there's been much work on, starting with that generalized mirror symmetry paper that I've been referring to by Lewis, Waldrum, and so on, of making this fly. So you could start with not a Calabi-Yau, but with this set. But I think there's been no progress on is what are these forms that we're supposed to expand J and omega in?
It satisfies certain internal field equations.
If they're spherical harmonics?
Well, the original omega I were a function on the internal manifold.
Right, they were harmonic, so they were closed.
And therefore, they satisfied the restriction of the field equation to the internal manifold.
Yes.
Now, here you have a first-order differential equation, you could call it the Krakauer equation. Do they, in addition to that, still satisfy what in generalization of the field equations you have?
Okay. So the answer is that's hard to answer for the following reason. This whole procedure of Kolitsa-Klein reduction, where you start with a solution and then you expand around it, so that works if you start with a solution in 10 dimensions. Yes. Now all of these Calabi-Yau compactifications are with fluxes. You don't really have a solution to work with to derive to derive these operators.
I understand. You've gone more general.
Why?
But still.
Why? Well, because, I mean, for example, you don't even have a metric.
Why?
On a Calabi-Yau?
You don't have it explicitly.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And so the reason Calabi-Yau compactifications work is because you have a lot of structure on the moduli spaces and you know that those project onto. But
in
general.
Sense, I mean, usually, from the things, examples that I'm familiar with, the moment you turn on H3 flux, you should expect this to happen.
Mm-hmm. You should expect this to happen. This being
right.
This?
Everything. Because you have torsion, typically. You should have torsion proportional to the
H3. So let me rephrase. Maybe what you're saying. So I've showed you that if I turn on H3 flux, but I don't do any of this, so I do my reduction in terms of the original harmonics, I get a reasonable result in four dimensions. You're saying what you would have expected is that I should turn on H flux and now modify my whole ansatz.
Everything should be modified because we know that H flux gives you torsion.
I think the difference again is if I'm starting in 10 dimensions by expanding around a solution. Or not, right? Because this intuition of starting around a solution and then reducing gives you in four dimensions also a theory that's expanded around its ground state, right? Whereas what we want is really a theory with a potential, and we want to have several ground states that we can expand around. So this is the analog of what you did cleanly in a nonlinear reduction of, say, 11-dimensional supergravity on S7, right? But we don't know how to do the nonlinear reduction here. Let me actually add a few comments, and then I think this is kind of becoming a nice topic to discuss this afternoon. Okay, so this is difficult, and it would be nice to work out. Let me end by saying what the prize would be. Okay. So if we figure out, without having a Calabi-Yau in the background, where we then, you know, modify the alphas and omegas that were given to us from the Calabi-Yau. If I just give you an SU3 structure manifold, maybe in a reduced class, and you can give me the corresponding gauge supergravity in four dimensions, what would that buy us? So it would teach us a lot about these manifolds. First, it would tell us that there's some special Kähler and quaternionic data. Okay, and we could ask questions like, is it the same special class of special Kähler and quaternionic manifolds that we can get from Calabi-Yaus, or is it different? There's some integral data. which corresponds to the charges that we have in gauge supergravity. So the question is, where is that hidden over here? And thirdly, if you give me a gauge supergravity, I know how to turn off the charges, right? What I mean by that is I know how to consider an associated action where I just take all of the hypermultiplets to be massless. So there seems like there's some deformation. I'm sorry, not massless, uncharged, which then actually implies massless. There's some deformation of SU3 structure, of FM, which should give me ungauged supergravity. And we think we know how to get ungauged supergravity from 10 dimensions. That's on a Calabi-Yau. So I put deformations in the inverted commas because this is integer data, so it's not a continuous deformation. But there's some parameters we can play with, it seems, to start with an SU3 structure manifold and end up with a Calabi-Yau. There seems like there's some Calabi-Yau still lurking in the story. So these are, I think, interesting questions, and it would be nice to get a handle on them. Okay, and end with that. So maybe. Okay, so in terms of the extensions, no.
Okay.
I mean, the problem of looking at type 2A brought in some new tools for looking at flux compactification. For example, one thing I didn't mention is that, so when you have compactifications with fluxes, like you mentioned in your talk, you always have these runaway potentials, so you need some additional ingredient. And for type 2B, you have orientifolds, right, which are negative tension objects. Here, it turns out the Wolschied instantons play that role. So as soon as you take Wolschied instanton corrections into account in the special Kähler metric, that changes the potential in a way to give you minimum. So you learn interesting things about moduli stabilization there. But now the second part of the talk, or this aspect of the talk, wasn't related to that. You had a question?
Yeah. So getting back to what I just asked, do you know for sure, if you turn on H-flux, and you take an ordinary Calabi-Yau undeformed,
yes.
Does that actually, can you prove that there is a solution to 10-dimensional supergravity of that form?
You want a solution?
I don't think an explicit solution.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't think there is a solution.
So you don't think
there is? No, we're not expanding
with a Calabi-Yau, undeformed Calabi-Yau and H-flux.
An H-flux.
Right.
In fact, I'd be sure that there is no solution, right? Because if it's a solution without, it'll source the metric if you turn on H-flux.
Right.
So you want a metric on the Calabi-Yau that...
Well, my question...
Yeah, actually, I'm not sure, but I don't know of a solution. So you're saying don't take the Calabi-Yau metric, but take a metric that satisfies...
The form, take the SU3 structure metric is the one that conjecture would exist.
I don't know, actually.
I can give you one example, a rather trivial and boring example of an SU3 structure manifold.
Okay.
Which is actually it's a subgroup, which is just S3 cross S1. The Wessamino-Witten model on S3 cross S1.
Okay.
That actually, of course, that's going to have an SU2 structure rather than SU3, so that's has more supersymmetries. But at least it has non-trivial. It's an explicit solution with non-trivial H flux. So it might be a laboratory. I mean, maybe it's all that's already.
See, I'm not sure if an explicit solution is what we're looking for. Again. Because
you
of
really
this,
want to know the moduli.
Because you know what you want in four dimensions is this full action, the full gauge supergravity action. You don't want the action expanded around minimum.
What are the dimensions of the five symbols in here? A, B, alpha, beta, and omega.
What is the index runover? Is that
the dimension? Omega is a form.
Oh, I see. So this is a two form. So this is a three form. These alphas and betas are three forms, and these are scalar coefficients.
They're scalars. They're not functions. They're scalars.
They're supposed to be constants.
They're constants. They're numbers.
Yeah.
Integers, presumably.
Integers.
Alpha's a three form. Right.
Alpha's a three form.
Then D alpha is a four form.
Yes.
Right. Omega.
Upper I is a four form.
But abstractly, So these are the on the six manifolds, so these are like the dual forms, omega pi.
Well, on the collab, yeah, they were dual forms in the sense that.
So what are they here?
Well, here they're not dual because I can't tell you what this is. I mean, this is a four form. It's a basis of. I mean, I'm sorry. It's a harmonic four form. This one, but this is. I'm not sure. It's a two form that satisfies this property.
Omega. So these are supposed to be closed four forms.
Yes. So omega I is supposed to be an H four. Well, you know.
Well, I mean, d omega I is zero.
Yes.
And these A's and B's play the role of the charges.
Yes.
They are the charges.
Yes.
So I would conjecture once you turn on H plus, you are forced into this situation. But the stuff you did with H plus is really doesn't exist.
Well, again, you're assuming the correct procedure is to expand around a solution, and this isn't right.
Well,
and this is not doing that. This
no,
is giving you
expand around all solutions. Let's assume, suppose we could write down the most general solution with all the moduli explicitly in the data.
Okay. So you mean like the analog of the nonlinear ansatz of whatever, Kremer and Julia for S7 reductions of, is that what you're talking about? Because that's the cleanest way of doing
I'm sort of in the spirit of, let's say, Manton, you know, moduli space approximation. So really, you had the full thing, you had all the moduli in there,
mm-hmm.
you knew what they were all were, we could write down the most general thing, then you would find, I'm conjecturing, then you would find that having H-flux and having a Calabi-Yau, undeformed Calabi-Yau would not be consistent, would not be a solution, would not give you a minimum one in the vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
The details, but when you turn on flux, you don't really get a Calabi-Yau amplification. You have a warp power.
So, again, there's two different...
Even for any flux. For Ramon flux is also...
I
see, okay.
This is true in 2B, though. Right, in 2A, it's not that simple.
Well, the jump is gets... Certainly, it's not far. Yeah, when you turn on flux. As you said, it's going to back react one way or the other. So.
Right. But in 2A, I mean, in 2B, it back reacts in a simple way for at least some types of fluxes that you actually get a Calabi-Yau metric just with a warp factor in front. Whereas in 2A, it's not even that simple.
So that's the only condition on your internal functions you propose?
Ferrara proposes?
Yes.
There's one more constraint, which is due to the fact that you want d squared of omega to be zero.
That's not d squared of omega zero. No, it's just consistent.
No, it's not consistent because d alpha a is this.
Yeah. Yes.
So you have one constraint. Exactly.
But a b minus b a is zero.
No, it's
automatic.
No, it's not automatic. There's, it's like
I'm
a.
The
indices are swapped.
Okay, so I see.
You're allowed to act with d on this equation, and it should be zero if this is supposed to be a differential.
Sure.
But now d of alpha is not zero, so you get a consistency condition on your setup, which is this.
Yeah, but that's contained in this set, so.
No, it's not.
Well, it's contained in the sense that it follows from it.
Yeah, exactly. It follows.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Okay, so this is the only set I impose, and of course, consistency. But
yes.
Okay. So that's very much weaker than the original.
The original
had field equations and so
on. Oh, no, I'm not sure. This is on top of what we did to get from the Calabi-Yaus with fluxes to.
We
do everything, so we have to still have relations on.
Is there more? Is did not the only set I must impose on omegas? I still have field equations. No, I guess.
No, so we use the field. No, because we use the field equations to derive that the omegas have to be harmonic,
right,
and now we replace that. Okay, good. Yeah, we replace that by this. Yes.
I would argue if you looked at the field equations in the presence of fluxes, you should get this.
Well, see, it's not really clear what you mean by get. You're saying, okay, I think what you're saying is you should get the operators, the modes of which you should consider, these should be modes, omega and alpha should be modes of that operator satisfying this constraint.
That's right.
So
instead of getting the condition, if you turn on the fluxes, if you.
So
we should be able to deduce
that. This is a little strange. You see, the fluxes have only one label up. He's having one label down. The I is not natural from the flux viewpoint. You could say that you can generalize the flux to saying that the D of a two form is a three form cohomology class. But that label I is not necessary for that. In fact, that's very strange from that viewpoint. You don't need a cohomology 2 class to label a cohomology 3 class. His AIA is a 2 and a 3 cohomology mixture. It's a mathematically very bizarre object that he's introducing. So I don't think it's just a flux. The flux will have only A index, not I and A.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to get at is this set, if I iterate or whatever, still giving, in addition to this, in your opinion, field equations? Or do I completely abandon the idea of the original field equation, only replace it by this? Is it a kind of BPS idea or so?
It has to be consistent with field equations.
Well, so you're asking, for example, what is D star D of omega I?
For example, yeah.
Well, okay, so we can answer that, but I guess we can't answer that just based on this input, right? I can't tell you what D star is without. So I can't derive the field equations from.
Will there be something like field equations or not? It's a philosophy point.
It must be.
So as Martin keeps stressing, one point of view is that you start with the correct field equations.
Yeah.
You look at the modes of those.
You go so far away, then you're still doing really Kaluza-Klein. But I thought that what you're doing is here in lower dimensions, you abandon all these restrictions. You have an enormously more general theory, only having this. So I'm trying to figure out which of the two.
This is for compactification. This is all about the.
So I think it's okay. I think it's not completely.
Well, it could be that this, if you look at the solution of this set of equations, that it.
Yeah, no, I don't.
Satisfies also some second order differential equations.
I don't think you have enough information to derive that.
Okay, well, there's nice discussions which can continue at 3 o'clock this time. I mean.
Maybe.